Welcome, welcome, welcome. Gladys, Poddies and my Tweethearts, my new category of listener. Oh, no, tweeting isn't listening, is it? Well, you know what I'm getting at. Look, awards. I want to discuss awards briefly before I introduce the guests with whom we're going to spend the next hour. They hand them out, you know, too easily, too readily. Look at the Nobel Peace Prize, for God's sake. You know, Henry Kissinger won one of those. Bloody outrageous. The much-vaunted Templeton Prize. We've talked to lots of Templetonian prize winners on the program. They gave one of those to Billy Graham. Think of the rotten paintings that have won the Archibald. Think of some of the Dills, the no-talent Dills that have got Logies or Oscars and so on. But there is one award which is incredibly precious and is very, very rarely given out. And I'm proud to say it's the koala stamp of this little program. I don't give them away too often, but I've decided to have a new series of programs where I give a koala stamp to someone I think has, absolutely been worth feeding, someone who's made a great contribution or contributions, plural, someone who's pulled his weight, fought above his weight, and, as I said, been worthwhile. Case in point, the bloke sitting opposite me, an old friend, we've been friends for, well, I don't know, 30-odd years, Richard Harold Smith, a.k.a. Dick. And as you know, entrepreneur, philanthropist, businessman, aviator, political activist, and as he modestly says, a...
car radio installer. Car radio. No, that's all I am. That's I'm very proud of it.
Yeah, just a car radio. Do you still do one?
I haven't done much car radio installation, but I still go into the Dick Smith shop, which I sold 35 years ago, and buy some components. And after about 10 minutes, the young salesman starts to think, that looks like Dick Smith. And you can see he goes off to the manager and asks, and they're looking at me, and finally they work out it is me.
Well, you do look a bit like Dick Smith, yeah. I have to say. In the same way, of course, that Colonel Sanders looks like Colonel Sanders, there's another human brand name, a bit like you. He had nothing to do with the company in the end, the poor old Colonel.
That's right.
But they kept him on as a ghostly presence.
It's interesting. I met him once at the Channel 10 studio there at North Ryde, and there was in the green room was Colonel Sanders, so I met him.
I met him too.
Oh, but because you've met some famous people.
Our lives have intersected over and over and over again. We'll talk about some of that later. Dick, I want to start at the end and work backwards. I want to talk to you about a couple of your most recent activities. One of them where you went out and tried to save a beetroot crop. What were you on about?
What I was on about is that, I mean, there's no one who's benefited more from growth and globalisation than me. And I've, as pointed out to me all the time, Dick, you've imported all these electronics from overseas. And I believe that you should do what you're good at in globalisation. The Swiss make the best watches, the Japanese the best electronics, and we grow the best food. But I've been finding out in the last decade or so that we're actually not allowed to grow food. And I dropped in, I was with my wife Pip, and we were coming back from actually west of Ayers Rock. We'd been making a documentary on Lasseter's Lost Reef. And as we came over...
That's another of your lifelong obsessions, isn't it?
Absolutely. But anyway,
That's where you get your money from. Found the bloody thing.
Be quiet. Anyway, I landed at this farm in the Carra Valley and spoke to this farmer, which I'd met before, and he said, oh, see this crop of beetroot? I'm about to plough it back in. And I said,
his beet was rooted, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And I said, that's not possible. Why would you do that? There's a billion people who are hungry in this world. And he said, well, Aldi, the German Aldi company, are now selling beetroot at 75 cents a can, and it costs about 95 cents a can to produce it. Even to me, 95 cents sounds unbelievably cheap. Anyway, I bought the whole crop. I said, no problems, I'll buy the crop, and I'll, with my Dick Smith Foods company, I'll sell it at the cost price, in effect 90 cents, and we'd get Woolworths or Coles to buy the crop and we'd sell it for $1.50, which is the price of beetroot for the last decade, and half the price of a cup of coffee. Well, they refused to buy it from me, and they said no.
Is that just because you give them the shits?
No, it's because they've matched, when Aldi started to sell it for 75 cents, they had to match the price, so they sell it for 75 cents. Immediately, Heinz sacked all its workers, closed down the processing, it's moving overseas. And I'm a proud capitalist, but when you get towards the limits. It's like religion, extreme religion, you end up with planes flying into buildings and killing people. Extreme capitalism is where you get the chief executive of Coles getting $16 million a year with no risk at all, and the farmer ploughing back his crops and having no income at all, and the country town closing down. In the end, by the way, with the beetroot, we ended up giving it away at
Manly. It was like a scene of the loaves and the fishes, really.
It was. Yeah, and all these people came and got their little brown paper bag, a bit like Bjelke Petersen time, with beetroot in it, our beautiful beetroot. In fact, we've been donating it to charity and everything. It's beautiful tasting beetroot, but we can't sell it to anyone. And that's
very,
the story.
Very sad. Well, on behalf of beleaguered food producers everywhere, Dick, that almost justifies a koala stamp in and of itself, but there are a few other areas where I think you deserve one. Another has been your support, and this is a matter of common interest, on refugee issues. Talk to that.
Well, my thing is, first of all, borders are unfair. They're unjust. And I remember talking to Bob Brown, and he said, "Oh, Dick, we've got to make it fair." I said, "Bob, the only reason we have borders is to be unfair." Fortunately, I think, isn't it fortunate that countries like Bangladesh and Ethiopia, poor countries, have borders? Luckily, we can rationalise that it's okay to have a border. So if you're going to have something that's unfair in the first place, you've got to have a little bit of fairness with it. And I quite like the idea of, as you know, I've been talking about the problems of growth and population, but our refugee intake, our approved intake's about 12,000 a year. I'd like to see that double to about 24,000 a year. I must admit I'm concerned about the boat people which are coming all the time, because naturally it means you don't have the control, and people who have really got the money. In most cases, I think it's Australian families who are sending the money overseas to bring these people here. But also there's this conflict of trying to make something fair. So what I've tended to do, Peter Kasim was an Indian national who got locked up for 7 years in one of our terrible camps. And in the end, he said, "Look, okay, you win. I want to go back home to Kashmir." But then the Indians wouldn't accept him. And so he was going to be locked up forever. So I got involved in helping him get out. As you know, I've always been concerned about fairness, you know, people being fair. I was in a cult, I must tell you this, as a kid. Not many people know this. It was called the Boy...
Your secret is safe here, Dick.
Ah, rightio, right. Good. It was the Boy Scouts. And
this is one of the things where we part bloody company. I was expelled from the Boy Scouts.
Right. Well,
it was just for setting fire to the Scoutmaster's desk. You won some bloody Baden-Powell.
The only qualification I've got, other than a car radio installer, is I've got the BP award. And someone said, the British Petroleum Award. Fantastic. I said, no, the Baden-Powell Award, the top award in scouting. But as an 8-year-old, I was taught to do a good turn for someone every day. And then as a scout, I had to help other people at all times. That's sort of ingrained into me. And so I like to try and help people because I'm well off.
That explains why you've got your Rovers outfit on today. I wondered why you came in dressed like that.
Shh, don't tell anyone.
That was to dramatise the thing.
Yeah, I've got my woggle and dib, dib, dib.
Well, talking about woggles, the great thing about Baden-Powell, I've never forgotten, is that he was worried about the rising sap of pubescence with young scouts. So he actually instructed them to have cold water, always handy, so you'd pour it on your genitals.
I didn't know that.
Be prepared.
One.
Be prepared.
Do you know what? The scouts now have girls in them.
See that water there? Oh. That's not for drinking.
The scouts now have girls. You don't have to perv on the girl guides over the fence. They're all combined now.
Okay. So we're rattling through a few things here. There's perhaps an inconsistency with your concern about borders and the unfairness, your great worry about the appropriate population level for Australia, and the daunting fact that with the passage of time and the rise of the seas, quite a lot of island nations and large places like Bangladesh in the neighbourhood are going to be underwater. So if we've got boat people problems now, we're going to have a huge amount later. What's your attitude to the morality of saying, on the one hand, enough, enough, we don't want any more people living here, and the fact that we're going to have to take our fair share, or perhaps more than our fair share.
Well, first of all, there's no morality in borders at all. They're immoral. They're against any fairness, any person born in this world should have the same rights to the world's resources. Now, I'm not planning to change it because I'm selfish and greedy and all the rest of it. So the borders are immoral in the first place. But what I'm interested in is total population of the world, not just Australia. I think just about every problem we have in the world today is going to be made worse by having more people.
Including fighting for resources, dwindling
Absolutely.
Resources,
and,
fighting for water.
And the so-called climate change. And I think what will happen with countries like Bangladesh is they'll build dikes like Holland.
Well, Holland can afford. Holland can afford to do it. Holland's a wealthy country.
Well, maybe we've got to build the dikes for the people in Bangladesh. Because, look, it's interesting about population. In fact, I've moved on a bit from it. I started off being concerned about this idea that we should go for 36 million and then no doubt 100 million, then a billion. And I've suddenly realised that our problem is that the economic system, which I've benefited from greatly, is not sustainable because it's an economic system that requires the perpetual growth in the use of resources and energy. And everyone knows with common sense, it's a finite world. So what we should be planning for now is an economic system, and I believe capitalism will work perfectly well, but just without the growth in the use of resources and energy.
How does a capitalist system, which is basically has an endless appetite for energy, an endless appetite for money, an endless appetite for market share, how does capitalism transform itself into something that can achieve a degree of sustainability?
Oh, by democracies bringing in laws, and I think the best example, the laws now, which create an even playing field on environmental protection for business, people wouldn't have believed 50 years ago we could exist. And look at, say, ICI.
But a great many of those laws have been revoked, say, during the Bush administration.
Well, yeah, but here in Australia, you can't whack chemicals from the ICI factory into Botany Bay anymore. Now, all around the world, chemical companies can't just whack their chemicals into bays anymore, so it's a level playing field. I think to solve this growth addiction, you just need sustainability laws, which will say things like you cannot produce anything unless in a given year you've replaced what you've taken. Now, you'd have to do this over a number of decades because you'll have recession if you suddenly try and change. But, Philip, I've worked out in my simple mind that up until the Second World War, we used the productivity gains of capitalism to reduce working hours, because 2 or 3% per year to reduce working hours. Since then, we've used the productivity gains in this measure of gross domestic product to actually make more stuff.
When Barry Jones wrote his wonderful book, Sleepers Wake, he was convinced that what would happen was that as technologies delivered more and more goodies, more and more toys, more and more productivity,
yes,
that we would shrink the working week, that we would reduce it and reduce it and reduce it, allowing vast tracts to be filled by curiosity, by doing, having fun, learning.
So I'm not an intellectual like you, but he's absolutely right. And since the Second World War, the only way we've kept people working is to make more stuff. So if you go into a shopping centre today, half the stuff there is rubbish. But if you stop buying it, we'd have mass recession. Because the productivity gains have been used to make more stuff, not to reduce working hours. And if we actually brought in laws that said you actually can't make stuff, say a Nokia phone, you can't make a new Nokia phone unless you hand back the old one and they make the new one out of the old one. Now, you're going to end up with mass unemployment, so you've got to reduce working hours. And I'm utterly convinced if we could get a few learned people to say, hold on, one day the growth has to stop, does that mean we just have a complete collapse and start again? Or could we actually have a system of capitalism which doesn't require growth? And I'm absolutely positive we can.
For centuries, we had, right through the medieval era, we had working hours limited by religious observations. Now, if you look at Bruegel paintings, you see them lying around half asleep. You know, they've just been harvesting some hay and all that stuff. And now, most of the year on those sort of farms, there wasn't a lot to do. During winter, nothing to do, for God's sake. But there were so many religious holidays. Do we need more holidays? Would that be a good tactic?
Absolutely. That would be one way.
A Dick Smith day, for example.
Definitely. And a Philip Adams day, even more importantly.
A week, I would have thought.
A week, yes. But that's what we have to go looking to. Now, Let me explain to you how we've actually gone backwards. We kid ourselves that every generation is better off than the last generation. And we are when it comes to affordability of cars or, say, world travel. It's a 20th the price it used to be. But let's look at one of the most important things. As a kid, I grew up in the northern Sydney suburbs of Roseville with a backyard. I was a free-range kid. Now, my dad was a salesman. My mum was a housewife. Oh, you're not allowed to use that these days, are you? Anyway, she was a housewife. And I had this wonderful, idyllic childhood going down into the bush at Roseville Bridge, just wonderful. Now, we can't do that anymore. My children both are working to be able to pay off a mortgage. And what's incredible is if we go to 36 or 40 million, they're now going to approve 60-story high-rise for our children. Now, for our families and our children, actually, we're going to end up with battery kids. Now, we spend $50 million a year on free-range chook eggs. Well, what about our kids? Why would we want to put them into 60-story buildings?
Freeze for a second, Dick. Take a deep breath. Yep. Prepare for the next round. Whilst I tell people that you are Richard Harold Smith, this is LNL on RN, and this is our first program where we formally present you with the guest with a koala stamp. We haven't actually made them yet. Is that all right?
Well, I'm going to go to the trade practices because this is, it's false what you're saying. You're talking about
koala stamp. It's a metaphoric koala stamp. Right, it's got a very small footprint.
Yeah, because I can imagine you desperately people wanting to come on the show to get a koala award and it doesn't exist.
Barry Humphries used to have a whole variety of stamps and he'd put them on his letters or on his envelopes. I've got a letter from Barry, and on the front, there's a stamp with a big finger pointing. Please observe hideous Australian stamp.
Now, I loved, our friend James Randi had a stamp which said, see your doctor. And if someone wrote him a letter, which he thought was a bit weird, he'd put the stamp on it, see your doctor. So I got one made up, a see your doctor stamp, but I was never going to use it because I thought, I'm going to use it. And then some poor little deluded person will go to the Australian or the Sydney Morning Herald and it'll be on the front page how they committed suicide because of my stamp.
Do you have within your psyche an authoritarian streak? In other words, would you in fact make a slowly reducing population mandatory? Would you like the China one child policy?
No, I'm personally totally opposed to that. And in fact, once you educate women anywhere in the world, populations go down because women are sensible. And there are some good examples of that. First of all, Japan, the economists are saying, oh, it's going to go from 120 million to 90 million. But wait for it, they have a $20,000 baby bonus. Japanese women are sensible, they're having less kids. Once you educate people, especially a woman, and they've got contraception, they'll make the right decision. And in Australia, our population is actually reducing by the birth rate. It's our huge immigration that's getting our explosion.
Of course, in China, on the mainland now, the authoritarian regime is likely at any minute to cancel the one-child law. In fact, de facto cancellation is taking place because they suddenly realise they don't have enough youngies to drive the great economic machine.
Oh, it's the great Ponzi scheme. See, that's what I'm told all the time. And anyone who's listening, most people would understand the stupidity. What we're told is, oh, look, you're going to have an ageing population, so we'll need to have great immigration or birth rate. The problem with that is, when do you stop? As Bob Carr said, when is enough's enough? If you need an economy to have growth in the use of resources and energy, which ours does, it's perpetual growth and it never stops. And one day, and the bigger it gets, the harder it is to fix. So my view, after reading what I can on it as a simple car radio installer, is that it's just common sense. One day you have to stop this perpetual growth, and it's absolutely possible. When I look at nature, I think, are we going to be like, is the human race going to be like grasshoppers or locusts that breed in billions and then die of starvation in billions? Or could we be like just about everything else in nature, the beautiful galahs, the beautiful bird life, which has probably lived in a niche for 2 or 3 million years?
Well, beehives, ants' nests, termites, vast populations.
They don't just keep expanding?
But they're fairly stable.
They must be stable because, see, nature doesn't allow exponential growth. There's only two things who believe in exponential growth, and that's economists and cancer cells. But the cancer cells kill their host.
Yeah, let's look at place, times and places where our paths have crossed. One of them was when you and I and Mark Plummer, recently deceased, kick-started the Australian Skeptics. That was worth doing, wasn't it?
Very worthwhile because, as we know now, the Australian Skeptics is booming. It has sort of a yearly convention. It hadn't had a huge effect because the human power to self-delude is unlimited. We know that.
Yeah.
But if you remember, we started it because we were testing water diviners. And I remember at the time saying to James Randi, who we brought out from the United States to test these water diviners.
We should remind people that James Randi, the amazing Randi, he sounds like the name for a porn star, but he is in fact a great magician.
Great magician and a famous skeptic. And he had tested water diviners because, as you know, any farmer you go to says, or so many can get a couple of rods and the rods will bend, it looks effective and they can find water. So we tested these water diviners and I remember halfway through the test I said to James Randi, look, I don't want to go ahead with this because we're going to destroy these people's belief in themselves. And Randi said, Dick, you will have no effect on their self-belief.
No,
and sure enough, when they all failed our test, they still believed as much as ever. It was an incredible thing about the human condition.
Yeah. One of the things, unfortunately, is I think scepticism has now got a bad name. Not Australian skeptic scepticism, but, say, climate change skeptics.
Yes, I think one of the problems there is that a so-called climate change sceptic is now almost a person who denies that there's evidence that humans could be affecting climate. Well, the sceptics, if you look at PSYCOP, the American parent body, and the Australian sceptics, they both say no. They agree basically that 90% of climate scientists say that we're affecting the climate. So true sceptics are actual believers in the fact that humans could be affecting climate.
So we've got to be sceptical sometimes about sceptics.
Absolutely. And you can't deny something. I mean, my attitude to climate change is, look, no one knows for sure it's so complex, but the research I've done shows that most of the qualified people believe there's a 90% chance we could be affecting. By the way, that's not 100%. You can't know for sure, but it seems logical that by burning up fossil fuels that have taken billions of years to sequester, if we burn them up in a couple hundred years, we could affect the climate.
Would seem very likely. Now, one of the moments that when we brought Randi out, it wasn't simply for water testing. It was to get him to show what was going on all over the place with alleged spoon benders.
And psychic healing.
Psychic surgeons, do you remember that?
Yeah, you were the patient.
Well, I was one of the patients.
In fact, was that true? Was he really taking tumours out of your stomach?
He was. That's why I'm well today.
Ah, fair enough. Well, when he did the operation on you, I was watching, there were a camera, and it looked to me as if he was actually taking a tumour out of your stomach. So that's, of course, what a good magician can do. And that's what these people in the Philippines, the charlatans, are taking money from people.
Well, I want to remind you of the first press conference we had. It was in your old office, and here's James Randi, and we had every camera crew in Sydney was there to set the thing up. It was an amazing event. He saw that I was lighting, because I smoked heavily then, I was lighting a cigarette, and he grabbed it out of my mouth and he put it on your desk.
Yes.
There it was. And he said, I'm going to show you psychokinesis. Oh. I'm going to make the cigarette move all over the
place. Like Geller can do, Uri Geller.
Like Uri Geller can do. So he says, I want you all to crowd around and cover me.
Yep.
And then he went around the room and he rubbed his fingertips on various fabrics, on the leather jacket of a cameraman, on your woolly jumper, on my shirt, until he found a fabric that was conducive to what was going to happen. He rubbed furiously. He went over and pointed his extended fingers at the cigarette, which started to move up and down and up.
Incredible.
The desk.
Magic.
And here are these trained observers, journalists, cinematographers,
me and you, and us
looking at it, absolutely flummoxed. And he asked us, all of us, how he'd done it. And everyone had a theory.
Someone had a magnet under the desk, I reckon.
Under the desk, static electricity. Yep. And he said, no. He said, I was blowing. And he said, all of you were focused as I wanted you to be on the space between my fingertips and the cigarette. That's where your cameras were looking, your eyes were looking. None of you were looking at my mouth. I was continuing to chatter away, but I was also going, hence the cigarette. Now, this is the principle of misdirection.
Yep.
This is what all conjuring and full stage size illusions are based on, misdirection. I also think it's what politics is based on. You ask a politician a question and you are misdirected over there to another answer, which is not what you asked for.
Right.
Politicians are brilliant at misdirection.
Well, that's just happening at the moment with Sydney and the Sydney airport thing. I mean, there's more chance of having a nuclear waste dump in Sydney and having another airport. We're not going to have one, unless you could have a dictator. That's the only one you'd get one. But it's amazing how they misdirect. Barry O'Farrell saying Canberra. Minister Albanese saying Wilton. Just misdirect anywhere.
Dick Smith is my guest, and this is Eleanor on RN. Okay, this really takes us to another part of your career, which was your period running the civil aviation industry in Australia, where you lost an awful lot of your political friends.
Oh, did I? Oh.
Yes, you did.
Yes, well, I reduced staff in the combined organisation from 7,000 to 3,500.
Did you want us all to die in aircraft?
No. And in fact, the safety's got better. And so we saved about $100 million a year, which is nearly $2 billion of what was just sheer waste. And that money hopefully has been spent on extra safety, more modern aircraft, better training. So that was a very hard thing to do because aviation safety is so emotive. Can you remember, Philip, that the dopey media said, oh, Dick Smith has introduced affordable safety, because I mentioned that the safety in anything is limited by what society can afford. We want...
Well, whether it's medicine or...
Absolutely. And we want things without risk, if possible. So I said, it depends on, in effect, what you pay for the air ticket. Well, wow, the bureaucracy didn't want anyone to know that. And even today, you can fly, so you could fly from Port Macquarie to Lord Howe Island in a small 9-passenger plane, or you could fly with the Qantas plane from Sydney. Now, they have two quite different regulated levels of safety. I wanted to tell people that. I remember I did a safety brochure that explained that, and the day when I eventually resigned as chairman, they shredded all the brochures, because bureaucracies love it to be kept emotive because you get lots of money thrown at you, instead of just saying, this is a simple science and it depends on effectively spending your resources to reduce risk.
Are we safer now than we were?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we've just gone the longest period in the world without a major airline fatality. As you know, in Australia, we've never had...
We went very close on a few occasions.
Oh, well, look at the Qantas 380. Yeah. I mean, the fact that that didn't catch a light, especially when it landed with the fuel leaking out of the wing, was a lot of luck and a lot of skill. I'm interested because one day we're going to have a major airline accident in this country, and it will be nothing other than the odds catch up. It is uncannily safe, considering all the human beings involved in designing the planes, in running them. We have been so lucky, and I just can't see what's going to happen because people think flying is perfectly safe, which it isn't.
You, of course, have been quite a reckless aviator.
Oh, yes.
And I remember you years ago telling me the story of you whizzing around the globe in one of these little noisy little things. What are they called? Helicopters.
Helicopters, yes. Yeah.
And you're in the middle of nowhere. You're running out of gas. You are going to go down in the drink at any bloody second. And then miraculously, proving there is a God, there was, what was it?
A ship. But hold on, let me tell you the truth. First of all, I'm a risk manager. I've been 5 times around the world by myself in planes, 2 solo flights. I've done the first balloon flight from Australia to New Zealand and across Australia because I manage risk. And in fact, this shipboard landing was interesting. I wanted to do the first solo around the world flight in a helicopter. Every absolute record was held by Americans, not this one. Now, it was the time of the Cold War, 1982-83, and I couldn't get approval to fly from Japan to Russia to Alaska. So I came up with this idea, and I managed to put 3 drums of fuel on a ship, which left Yokohama and was heading to Seattle. And when it was halfway across the Pacific Ocean, I kid you not, I took off from Japan in pitch darkness, flew for 7 hours, found the ship, and rolling around in the ocean, pumped my drums in, and then took off and flew to Alaska. I wouldn't do that again. I was very lucky.
How has Pip put up with all this?
Do you know what she said to me?
Long-suffering wife.
I mean, I married her when she was 19. She was a Girl Guide. I was a Boy Scout. And she thought when I did my first...
Had you been playing with each other's woggles?
No, I wish we had. But I was an adventurer. And I had this idea to fly around the world in a helicopter. She thought, oh, that's good. He'll get it out of his system. She is a little bit annoyed that I keep doing adventures, because she'd prefer me just to become a normal, boring person like everyone else.
Why aren't you? What happened? I mean, is it genetic? I know there is a relationship, is there not, between you and Kingsford Smith?
No, no. Harold Casno, the pictorial photographer, is my grandfather. No relation with Kingsford Smith. I love the spirit of adventure, and I love to test myself and risk management. And the fact that I've done 5 flights around the world and I'm still alive, I mean, I'm more surprised than anyone, but it's about managing risk.
Do you fear death? Did you? No. Have you feared it?
I've been frightened on a number of the flights. I remember when I flew vertically around the world from Sydney to the South Pole, up to the North Pole, back to Sydney, I left Tasmania at night in this little tiny twin otter plane, and 2/3 of the way across the Antarctic Ocean, before I got to Antarctica, in pitch darkness, the compass started wandering around because it wouldn't work. And we thought the plane had accidentally turned and was heading back to the north, which would have been to our deaths because it was in pitch darkness over this wild ocean. We climbed the plane to 18,000 feet, turned on the lights, and just had blowing snow coming towards us. So, and at 18,000 feet, we had no oxygen, couldn't think. So we came down and I thought, well, we're going to die. And luckily, the midnight sun came up at about 3 a.m. and I managed to get a sun fix and worked out that we'd only turned 15 degrees, not 180 degrees, and we're okay. We finally then got the beacon and landed at Casey Station in Antarctica. Very, very lucky.
You've got grandchildren now. Would you encourage them to be as adventurous as you've been?
No. No, look, I've been incredibly lucky, especially to have a wife who's, you know, supported me and stayed with me when I've done these things.
Perhaps she just wants to get rid of you, Dick.
No, look, staying at home would be far worse than being on the actual adventure. But I've got this addiction. It's an addiction like any addict, and my addiction is taking a risk and seeing if I can get away with it. How's this? Sometimes I'll be flying up the coast towards Coffs Harbour in the helicopter, and I look out to the right at the ocean, and I think, and I'm tempted to turn right and see if I could get to Lord Howe or something. Now, I wouldn't have enough fuel, but there's that temptation. Oh, it'd be exciting to fly over that ocean, see if the engine will keep going. Quite interesting, isn't it?
Were you born into a religious family?
No. Mum and Dad were not really religious. I remember they sent me to scripture class, and when I was 5 or 6, I came home and I said, Mum, the scripture teacher says there's God on everyone's shoulder. And I said, there's hundreds of people in the world, so that's impossible. And she said to me, look, you just have to have faith, you know, and I unfortunately didn't.
It's wrong about us, isn't it? We are seriously, this is terrible that we don't have this gift of faith.
Yes.
And we question that we're...
Yeah, I'm a very simple type person. And
you fix car radios.
Car radio installer.
Yeah.
But I'm not really an atheist because I'm not that positive to know that there isn't a God. I just don't see any evidence. So am I an agnostic about agnosticism? Is that proper description?
I suppose that's right. Of course, to me, the greatest of all skeptics of the modern era is Martin Gardner, who wrote those wonderful mathematical puzzles for years in the Scientific American, author of any number of wonderful books, Fads and Fallacies, where he demolishes almost all the nonsenses that are available. But I remember he announced to fellow sceptics and Psychop and others that he did, in fact, have a vague belief in God. And there was a shocked response, absolutely shocked response. But finally, and he wrote about it very beautifully, he argued that it was finally unknowable and he just felt it was likely.
Yes.
Rather than unlikely, but that's not a view that I've ever taken, or you. Okay, let's move on to the issue of money. Now, someone said, God must hate money. Look at the dreadful people he gives it to, and one will sort of avoid a libel case by not mentioning a string of mining tycoons.
Oh, I do all the time, and no one says anything.
Well, I'm not, you know, the ABC would be cross if we got another writ.
No, you
but
won't.
But this is where, and I used to berate Packer about this, Kerry, about this. I said, you got all these squillions and scrullions, and yes, you do a little bit of offstage, backstage yep. generosity, but it's ad hoc and it's nonsensical. But you've got to, in fact, set up a great big foundation. And I talked him into it, and he was just about to have, and it had to be the biggest. It had to be 10 yes. times the size of the Maya Foundation, because he's an alpha male, and he spoke to, well, I'm not going to name yep. the names, a couple of very well-known.
And he obviously didn't do it.
Well, he didn't do it because of the Costigan inquiry, which hit him right yep. right in the knackers at about that time, and he became rather antisocial. But you are not, in fact, anything like as rich as some of these characters. But you seem to, in fact, give a greater percentage of your accrued profits from, you know, let's admit this, that story about fixing radios is rubbish. It's really come from drug pushing and from and from munitions selling
yes.
guns via the helicopter around the...
Absolutely, yeah.
But you do, in fact, spend more of your money as a percentage than these guys.
Yes, because I look on it as an obligation. Now, in the 1950s, when I was a kid, every wealthy person was also known as a philanthropist. You had the man, Sir Edward Holstrom of Silent Night Refrigerators and the Zoo, Sir Macpherson MacRobertson, MacRobertson of Chocolates. We had Sir Vincent Fairfax. They were all philanthropists. That's all changed.
And of course, the Jewish families for whom philanthropy is a part of the Judaic tradition have been the great overachievers.
Absolutely. And now, while you have some wealthy families now, Lindsay Fox family, the Lowy family are generous, but most of the wealthy people I know are just incredibly selfish. And for about 15 years, I've asked them quietly and behind the scenes, like, how about donating a few dollars? I've got nowhere. So now I out them, and I've been naming them. I started off with the four bank managers. They get $10 million a year each. I wrote to them and said, look, will you join me and give 20% of your income away? In their case, it'd be $2 million a year. And no way. I think I got an answer from one saying, oh, Dick, we're not show-offs like you. We do it secretly. But I've been in touch with all the large charities and the Red Cross, the St. Vincent de Paul, Salvation Army, and said, do you ever get any substantial amounts anonymously? And they say, never. And, Philip, what's sad is that we're so different to America. Peter Feynman said to me that in America, if you're wealthy and you're not known as a philanthropist, you're a social pariah.
Well, yes and no. We know that Buffett, working with you know, the Microsoft guy.
Yes, yeah, Bill Gates.
Bill Gates have set up this joint.
Oh, but that's
immense
huge
thing. But Buffett has also rattled the tin around America, around the 1%,
yes,
demanding that they sign up. Now, some have, but it is also a matter of record that most haven't.
In America?
Even in America, where the taxation incentives for generosity are significant.
Right, but in America, about the wealthy are known to give about 15% of their wealth away each year. In Australia, it's less than 1%. How's this for a figure? We have, of 6,000, there's 6,000 Australians who pay tax on more than $1 million a year, and some of them would earn 20 or 30 million. A third of those, 2,000 of them, do not claim $1 as a tax deduction. So when their accountant says, oh, look, you've just earned $15 million last year, now do you have any tax deductions? They'd say no. Oh, but did you give the salvos $100 on the Red Shield Day? No, nothing. These people are so selfish. Now,
What? Let's think about this for a minute. Let's become psychotherapists. Is it because of insecurity? Is it perhaps because they don't believe they deserve the money and therefore may be doomed to lose it?
I don't know. Look, you look at, say, we'll mention Rupert Murdoch because I write to him and I know him well, and his mother is the most generous person you could ever imagine. Dame Elizabeth Murdoch?
Yeah, Elizabeth. Yeah. Elizabeth's a good old chook. Yeah.
I wrote to Rupert. He's worth about $4 billion. He gets $33 million a year, but he's not known to give any money to anybody. People who work for him just say, mate, he's miserable. So I wrote to him and I said, Rupert, would you set up the first $1 billion foundation in Australia and call it the Dame Elizabeth Murdoch Foundation? I said, I'd put in $5 million, which is a hell of a lot for me, but that means you'd only have to put in $995 million. Well, he wrote back and basically said, get lost. He said, I do other charitable things, which we don't know what they are, and that's not my interest anyway, sort of thing. Now, I thought that was very sad because you've got a man who makes $100 million a year out of South Australia. He owns all the print media there, in effect. The money that he's taken out of Australia is enormous. they should be known as great philanthropists, but he's not. What's wrong? What was wrong with the training that didn't give him pleasure from doing the right thing?
There was one moment in your life where I was really cross with him. Do you remember what it was?
Probably so many things.
The Centenary of Federation. Oh, let me tell the story.
Yes.
Joan Kerner and I co-wrote a report to COAG, the Council of Australian Governments, on how we should celebrate the Centenary of Federation. Joan and I were appointed by Keating, but each of the states and territories appointed a rep, and we went round Australia working out what it was we should be celebrating on our Centenary of Federation, which of course was also going to coincide with the Sydney Olympics. And amazingly, we got everyone to sign off on it. And it included a commitment to the Republic, to reconciliation were the two principal things, which everyone across the spectrum agreed were inevitable. Even if they weren't enthusiastic about it, they thought, quote, it's inevitable, so let's sign off and get on with the rest of our lives. Of course, what happened was that Keating lost to Howard, lost big. And then Howard sacked the boss of the council, and that was Janet
Holmes of Court. Yeah, who would have been a wonderful chairman of it.
And she was the chairman.
Yeah.
And I wrote a piece to you, addressing you, saying don't take the job because I felt that you were going to be offered it. You were offered it by Howard, who was on a vengeful crusade, nailing, getting rid of anyone who'd been even partially sympathetic to the Labor government. And you took that job on. You didn't like it, did you?
No, I hated it. In fact, I can't remember any letter from you. That's an interesting one to me.
It was a column.
John Howard asked me if I'd be the chairman of the Centenary Federation Council, and I said to him, Prime Minister, there would be no one more hopeless than me at that. I said, I'm a car radio installer, and whereas I'm good at doing aviation reform because I'm an experienced pilot, when it comes to the Centenary Federation, he obviously decided that he was going to get Dick Smith. So over a period of 6 months, I agreed. And I was on there for 3 years until I eventually resigned. And I got some capable people, Rodney Cavalier, who acted almost as chairman. I was completely out of my depth and didn't like doing it.
I raise it because in some ways you are a political naive. You know, with all your smarts and all these other areas, you've been all over the place politically, haven't you?
Well, I'm not party political. I don't see any great difference between our two political parties. And a good friend of mine is Bob Brown, who's the third party. I won the lottery of life. I was born here in Australia in the 1940s, like you, and never had to go to war.
I'm the late 1930s.
Oh, right, yeah.
A younger bloke.
But we've never had to go to war, and we've just benefited from this wonderful, prosperous country and this wonderful free society where we've been able to do well.
You mentioned the fact that Howard wanted Dick Smith. Now, so did a certain corporation who wanted to keep the name on the front of the shops. I remember you, and you probably remember this, you've rang me up despairing of your own name.
Changing my name.
And you rang up and said, I'm thinking of changing my name by Deed Bob to escape the tyranny of being Dick Smith. And I suggested to you that would only compound the problem.
I'm actually thinking of doing it again because I've just heard that Woolworths are going to sell Dick Smith's. Right. And someone rang me up and said, they'd probably sell it to the Chinese Communist government because all these things are being sold off. And I said, in that case, I will change my name. So a current affair arrived with a baby name book. And here we are on television going through my new name.
I'll guarantee you,
if they do sell Dick Smith Electronics to the Chinese Communist government, I will change my name.
I've got a secret name, which I never use.
All right.
There's Philip Andrew Adams, but there's another name, which is so humiliating and so embarrassing that I've never used it. I will donate
that name,
one of my middle names, to you.
Yes. But by the way, it's possible. Remember the famous Ben Lexon, who won the America's Cup with his wing kill? He was Bob Miller of Miller and Whitworth. And he got fed up when he sold Miller and Whitworth, the ship chandlery place. He got fed up with everyone saying, that's Bob Miller from Miller and Whitworth. He changed his name to Ben Lexon. If he can do it, I can.
Well, leaving aside my gift of a name, which is like a helicopter pilot giving a kidney to Gary Packer, but I've got two middle names.
Oh, right.
Like he had two kidneys. Have you come to any sort of tentative conclusion about your rechristening?
No. At that time when I spoke to you about it, in fact, Tim McCartney Snape rechristened me in the Marciandi River in Nepal. I was rafting the river with my family and the raft overturned and everyone nearly drowned. And so we decided with a Vegemite jar, and it should have been an Aussie-mite jar, but a Vegemite jar, he rechristened me Kaz Smith because my grandfather was Harold Kasno and they always called him Kaz. So I'll probably change to Kaz Smith, I think.
You know there's another connection between us because there's that wonderful National Library book on Kasno for which I wrote the foreword.
You did. Yep.
It's funny the way we dance around.
And my mother
other.
Was so upset because your bit of humour at the end of the foreword said, he always strived to be a genius and occasionally he got there or something like that. And she was so upset that because she thought he was always a genius being her dad.
I'd like to talk to you now about stunts because this is one of your great redeeming features. You might have got a bit close to John Howard, but I forgive you because of some of the things you did. I'd forgotten that you served as the conductor on a London double-decker bus which jumped 15 motorcycles. Not a motorcycle jumping 15 buses, but vice versa. Apart from taking the piss out of Evel Knievel, what was that all about?
Well, that was after. If you remember, first of all, I towed the iceberg into Sydney Harbour on April Fool's Day. And that was because I'd said to everyone I was going to bring an iceberg up from Antarctica and cut it up and call it Dixicles and sell them for 10 cents each. And the media, I mean, as you know, people in the media are so gullible. I mean, you'd know that. And they believed it and they kept saying, when's the iceberg coming? And so just before April Fool's Day, Jerry Nolan, a friend of mine, said, Dick, why don't we bring one in for April Fool's Day? So we got a huge barge, 80 feet by 80 feet, covered with white plastic, firefighting foam on the top and shaving cream. We towed it out through the heads the night before. And then on the Friday, the day before April Fool's Day, we sent out a press release saying the iceberg's coming next week. Because we couldn't say tomorrow because they would have been suspicious.
Yeah, absolutely.
The amazing thing was the ABC rang up that night and they'd chartered a plane to go out and get a scoop on it. I don't know. Where is it? Is it off Wollongong? And it didn't exist, of course. It was still being made. But the funny thing was we towed it in through the Sydney Heads and I had about 300 staff working for me at Dick Smith Electronics in those days. So I gave them a list of all of the radio and TV stations' phone numbers, the newsrooms, and I said, get up at dawn on Saturday morning and ring the TV station and say, what's that coming through Sydney Heads? It looks like an iceberg. Well, every switchboard jammed. So you can imagine every media organisation thought, this is big. We've never had anything this big before. And so in the end, we had 10,000 people on the headlands as the iceberg came in. Now, then I sold the business to Woolworths. On the day the deal was done, Tony Harding, the managing director of Woolworths, very staid, and Sir Eric McClintock, and these are the most staid people. They said, oh, Dick, are you doing anything to create a bit of publicity about the sale? And I said, yes, I am. I said, you've heard of Evel Knievel. He's got a record of jumping his motorbike over 16 double-decker buses. I said, well, I can't ride a motorbike, so I'm going to jump a double-decker bus over 16 motorcycles tomorrow morning. And their mouths just dropped, and I noticed they were going to announce it the next morning, the takeover, so they decided to leave it until after the bus jump.
They must have come to the conclusion, the belated conclusion, that you were raving ratbag.
Completely mad. But do you realise that bus jump got publicity right around the world? It cost $1,300, and it's still, I see things on television occasionally, the maddest adventures, and my bus jump features on it. And it was great fun.
Of course, the iceberg thing had a sort of, if you like, a semi-serious aspect, didn't it? Because it's been a seriously argued proposition.
Absolutely.
That you could tow icebergs into major cities.
And may happen one day. The bit, of course, of...
Well, as global warming increases, they're going to be bobbing around a lot anyway, aren't they?
But also, cutting them up to ice cubes and calling them Dixicles and selling them for 10 cents each, that I would have thought they'd be a bit suspicious about that one, but they believed it.
Well, that's your Dick obsession is, of course, very problematic. Yeah.
Can you remember when Dick Smith Car Radio, we had a van called the Electronic Dick. And we had one van that used to drive around Sydney picking up radios and dropping them off. And people would say, oh, we see those vans everywhere because it was so noticeable.
It was only one van.
It was only one van.
Well, you see, that's a sort of misdirection, isn't it?
A little old lady rang me up. She said, Mr. Smith, I'm horrified about the electric.
No, I wasn't dishing
you. Yeah, I'm horrified about the electronic dick van. And I said, oh, I don't know what you're talking about. And so she decided then I was a very good, clean-living young bloke and I didn't know what it might imply.
I want to circle back and end where we began with beetroot and matters arising. And you have my wholehearted support because as food producers we know the impossibility of competing with with the foreigners and sometimes the stuff they bring in. Certainly in the case of garlic, is appalling. Most of the olive oil we get is the dregs.
You saw the chemicals that we used, you wouldn't believe it.
Well, I do believe it, because we avoid it. However, here's a dilemma, isn't it? We hear of people on the bones of their ass, they've got no money, you know, they're just one paycheck away from bankruptcy, and they're trying to save every cent in the supermarket. How do you deal with that dilemma?
Well, I think they should go to Aldi or Costco, but it would be great. Typical Australian families don't buy the cheapest motor vehicle. We tend to buy something in the middle of the range. How's this one for a figure? There's over $1 billion a year spent on premium cat food. This is the Dine, which is 60% dearer. So all I'd like for my Dick Smith Foods, I'd just love to have enough Aussies who'd say, look, we'll pay 20 or 30 cents more for better food that supports Australian farmers. But how's this? I've got these new fruit spreads, which we took 12 months to work on because 4 billion bottles of marmalade come in from St. Dalfour in France every year. We got the fruit spreads. Woolworths have stocked them, but Coles said, oh, no, they're 20 cents dearer, we won't sell them. So there's half the business that you need to be viable. They won't support us.
And yet, Coles and Woolies are constantly facing a barrage of criticism, not so much from the farmers who dare not speak out.
Absolutely.
But certainly from informed consumers.
How's this for sadness? And this gets back to what we started with about this thing of growth and capitalism. Woolworths are now the largest operator of poker machines in Australia. Now, you only have to know that something's gone crazy when a wonderful Australian-owned company by lots of mum and dad shareholders ends up in poker machines. Something's going wrong with capitalism, and it's this extremism of saying we must always have growth when it's impossible.
You gamble with your life, although you'd argue that you were,
careful
on the odds. Yeah. Are you opposed to gambling?
No, not at all. I'm not opposed to gambling, drinking, religion, anything. I love the freedom of choice. I must admit, I don't know enough about gambling. I've never, been on poker machines or anything like that. I wish there is a way of protecting the people who are vulnerable, because it seems sad to me if the club movement needs the terrible anguish of people who are splitting up families to stay in business. It doesn't seem logical.
Well, you're a problem gambler with your life, but it's your life and you can toss it away if you want to. Dick, right. I'm now going to hand you in this invisible box this metaphoric award, which I want you to cherish. Here it is. Your koala stamp.
Look, it's my imagination shows me that it's a beautiful koala and it's probably the best award I've ever achieved in my life. Thank you.
I think that's true. Richard Harold Smith, AO. Well, of course you are. Living National Treasure, you're one of those.
Yeah, I think I am, yep. Car radio installer.
And for 35 years or so, a mate of mine. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
That's it from LNL for another week. Thanks to the team, Chris Short, Muda Dardais, Anne Arnold, exec producer Gail Pizzaria, and special thanks to Jesus, otherwise known as Luke Purse, who's been looking after us while Paul Gough has been gallivanting all over the world. Thanks again, Luke. Stay tuned now to RN, and we will see you later.